I don't feel myself today. Moon said that I should get away. Go with mom, get a holiday. This rain is starting to mean that feeling won't go away. I wish the party got unlimited. Someone welcome is a visitor who stays a long, 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 long time waiting in the home. And it's a long, 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 long time before I'll come home. Please don't try and contact me. Battery from my phone. I didn't take my pills today. I wanna see what would have happened if I didn't worry and I let it drift away. So I could melt in the sunshine. I don't know myself today. Life is supposed to live our way. A long, 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 long time before I'll come home. It's a long, 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 long time before try and contact me. The river roams the battery from my phone. Please don't try and contact me. The river roams the battery from my phone.
Ah. Oh. Welcome, welcome. This is Brighton and Hove Community Radio, syndicated with Green Futures Festival Radio. I'm mesmerised, and I hope you will be too. Now, last week, I focused on the spoken word, and my plan was to follow it up by taking a look at the written word for this week's show. But I completely forgot that in the development of language, the written word was a long, long time in coming. And playing us in just now was Reverend and the Makers with Long, Long Time. So, what is a long, long time in terms of writing? Well, you know those pictures of animals painted on the walls of that cave in France? Is it at Lascaux? Well, they were the first pictures to be produced by our species. And it would be another 17 millennia, that's 17 millennia, before the art of writing made its appearance. Now, that's quite a brain-spinning fact to take in. And I've plundered most of today's historical facts from a fabulous little book called Writing, The Story of Alphabets and Scripts by Georges Jean. And I've just noticed two words still printed on my hand as I speak, and they read Commedia upstairs, where I was last night for a festival performance of In the Woods, which began with a larger-than-life puppet operated by three people. It was a strange creature called the Colossal Crumb, or the Crumb of Colossus, and it was very evidently anatomically female. But she seemed to be made up mostly of a sort of mass of coiled guts and intestine, big in body, with just a tiny, tiny little proboscis head, seated quite comfortably in a winged armchair, reading what appeared to be a newspaper and eating the occasional banana. But on closer inspection, the newspaper was a sort of broadsheet of lines and pictures, which is pretty much how language began for us, with those funny lines and squiggles and pictures. The crumbs of knowledge, a long, long way from our feast of media now. Then it was literally just the same old story repeated endlessly from generation to generation, like an affirmation passed down by word of mouth through families, through communities, history, poetry, religiosity, all rolled into one long series of repeated stories, all valuable. But when it came to valuables, people wanted something a bit more accurate. They wanted more accurate records. So the need was born to get it down in writing. Things like marriage contracts. Now, you know, not for the romance, sadly, but because cattle, camels and land would be at stake and people needed to be sure of what was coming their way and what was leaving. And then over tens of thousands of years, drawings and signs and pictures were used to convey simple messages, beginning with the need to account for things accurately. So we have clay tablet receipts of cattle, which was quite easily signified by just drawing a picture of a head of a cow. And everything had to be simplified. So a woman was signified by a triangle standing on its point with a little line or slit coming up from the point. Now, I don't want to say too much on that score, but if you draw what I've just said, you'll see it's a lady. Now, you could be a bit clever by a bit of judicious picture juxtaposition. So the lady triangle next to a picture signifying a mountain meant foreign lady, or the lady from the other side of the mountain. And all in all, that adds up to another way of saying slave. A bird next to an egg meant fertility. But the problem with this purely pictorial method was that it's kind of better disposed to deal with concrete things. Things, you know, that's quite easy. You can draw an apple, you can do a picture of a shoe, a jug, whatever. But it's not that good for dealing with sort of abstract thoughts or concepts or emotions or anything like that. And actually, it'd be quite hard to pin down what each picture meant, even in terms of itself. So, for example, a pictogram of a human foot could mean to walk, to stand up, to move. Now, each of those spoken words is very different, and it would have been so in any other language. Walk, stand up, move. But when it's just a picture, well, which meaning do you attach to it? Well, a lot obviously depended on context, but even then, as we touched on last week, a lot depends also on your own mental attitude when you look at simple messages. So there was an awful lot of scope for a message to be misread. And there, take that word itself. Is it misread or misread? On its own, without the context of other words, you can't be entirely sure how to read it. Are we in the present reading it wrongly, or did we misread it in the past? Was it misread? I don't know. Anyway, here's the Kings of Convenience with misread. Or is that misread? Oh, anyway, here it is.
Expect me to wrap it up and keep it there. The observation I'm doing could easily be understood. A cynical demeanor, but one of us misread. What do you know? It happened again. Friendly start of means you last to get somewhere. Somehow didn't notice friendship is an end. What do you know? It happened again. told me all throughout history, the loneliest people were the ones who always spoke the truth, the ones who made a difference, but we're standing in difference. I guess it's up to me now, should I take that risk or just smile? What do you know? Get up on again.
There you go. That was misread or misread. Now, that's obviously a question of tense, whether it's the past or the present. And I remember my brother telling me that Malay is a very easy language to learn, and he speaks it fluently because it doesn't have a tense system with all those sort of conjugated verbs that are always the hard part of learning a language. You have to take the context from the surrounding words next to the word that you want. So you wouldn't have I come, I came, I went, I will go. No, you have I come today, I come tomorrow, I come yesterday. But it's always the same verb. Actually, I never asked him how any of it was written. And I have to say, at the back of my mind, I'm curious to know how and why a culture places so little importance on pinning down time like the rest of us. But that's something for me to follow up at a later time. There's still a lot of iffiness in the language so far. So it's kind of like a spongy clutch. We haven't quite got the bite of accuracy. We've got quite a gummy language with no real teeth. But a significant leap of progress was made when signs and symbols started to mean more than just the things that they portrayed. They started to represent sounds rather than things, and that lies at the root of all true writing. But again, it started through the use of pictures, but more in the sense of that child's game, I think it's called a rebus, where carpet can be spelt by drawing a car and the family pet. So the Sumerian pictogram of an arrow, or T, as they would say, would be used to signify the word life, which also sounded as T. Scribes then had to create a way to let you know whether to read the sign pictorially, as an arrow, or phonetically, as life. So none of it's easy. But still, we've come a long way from lists of temple property, using squiggles as aid memoirs and accounts, to at long last being able to set down in writing the long-loved ancient Sumerian oral classic tale, the Epic of Gilgamesh. So at last they were able to stop talking about it and set it in stone, or press it into tablets of wet clay with a wedge-shaped bit of old reed and left to bake dry in the sun. And the script they use to make those squiggles was called cuneiform because of the wedge shape of the reed. Cuneus was the Latin for wedge. And the origins of such writing as we know it come from Mesopotamia. And there were sort of two main areas. You had the Akkadians in the north and the Sumerians in the south. And they kind of lived harmoniously in the same region. But their languages were completely different as English and Chinese. And they had their own form of cuneiform each. So now, what might you find on an Akkadian coffee table or bookshelf? Well, in the Royal Library, you might come across some of these classics. The Flood Tablet, Ishtar's Descent to the Underworld. There's Synchronistic History, that's the relations between Assyria and Babylon between the 14th and 18th BC. You would find The Meaning of Names. Ancient Mesopotamians were big on names. They were always meaningful. So, for example, Esarhaddon meant the god Ashur has given a brother. And one of my favourite books, I think, would be The Archaic Signs, which was the Mesopotamian version of Call My Bluff. It listed earlier pictograms that had come to light through building and restoration work that were baffling and needed deciphering even then. So it's what's fantastic is that we can actually just run up the road or get on a train or whatever and go to London, go to the British Museum and actually see these fragments of tablets. Oh, now I've left out the inordinate number of books on methods of divination. So how to tell someone's future by dropping a heap of animal intestines on the ground, and or how to determine your future career by gazing at chopped liver or the spots of a passing animal. But mostly it's all progress, little by little. And here's Little by Little by Groove Armada. Today, today,
today. Be where we really are.
Well, rather appropriately, that had an awfully slow start. And that's pretty much how it is with the written language. But onward, ever onward, let's leap forwards now, or sideways, to Egyptian hieroglyphs. Greek hieros for holy, and glyphine to engrave. So we have writing of the gods. As it was believed, the gift of writing was bestowed on mankind by the god Thoth. The earliest known hieroglyphs date back to the 3rd millennium BC, though they may well have originated before that. That's the earliest that we know of. And from then until the Roman occupation in AD 390, little changed in the actual signs themselves, except the volume increased. So we go from 700 hieroglyphs to about 5,000. And it's a beautiful written language, full of heads and animals and flowers and birds. And yet it's capable of recording not just things and concrete issues, but abstract thought and concept. Confusion. Well, obviously there's some kind of confusion. So where is the confusion in this one? Well, it's more to do with the direction that you actually read the lines. So normally, you'd read from right to left, and the direction of the animal heads and people's heads would corroborate this. There'd be an indication. But if an emperor's head puts in an appearance in that line, all the other human heads have to turn and face it. So the direction isn't quite so clear in that case. And then, just to confuse things a little bit further, there was even a form of writing called Boustrophedon, which translates as like an ox travelling back and forth when ploughing fields. So the top line you'd read from right to left, then you'd drop down and read from left to right, and when you get to the end of that one, you'd read from right to left again. Now, I don't know, you wouldn't know if you were coming or going. But if you went all the way and actually died, well, you could be pretty sure you'd be buried along with your very own copy of the Book of the Dead. Now, talking of which, I once caught sight of a book on a shelf in Mulescombe Library entitled How Long Have I Been Dead? Which I think is marvellous, but I hope that isn't the story of your life or mine indeed. But anyway, let's go back to the Book of the Dead. Now, this is like the AA guide to the next leg of your journey into eternity. It would have been read by a priest at your funeral and then stowed in the tomb with you. So when you get the chance to flick through it, you'd be prepared for all the stages of death and rebirth, starting with the Great Reckoning. Now, this is where your heart is put in a pan on one side of a balance or a pair of scales against the feather of Maat, that's M-A-A-T, which symbolized justice and truth. Now, the two would have to balance, or the Great Devourer would have you. And all of this would be presided over by the jackal-headed god Thoth, giver of language, himself. But perhaps I need tell you no more. I'm sure you can read all about it in the Egyptian Times by Zanderman. Or am I reading that completely out of context? Oh well, here are the Egyptian Times. Hey.
Leading us on through the desert, north past the sea. Your English is broken, but perfect to me. Like the rise of the tide that washes me away, falling upon my reins, calling me by my name, pulling me from my pain, pulling me turns, whose light drives us on.
Go and you even get the applause. So we're now going to switch cultures and make our way to China, which developed its own unique form of writing back in 2000 BC with a system that's still in use to this day. And fragments of tortoiseshell and deer scapula were found in the wake of the flooding of the Yellow River in 1899, on which were the oldest known examples of Chinese writing. Priests would write questions on one side of a tortoise shell in the characteristic top to bottom format, and then hold the shell towards a fire symbolically lit in the east. And the theory was that the answer to the question could be read in the shapes of the cracks caused by the heat. But like all the other languages, Chinese also began with pictograms. But the true essence of written Chinese is that a single sound can represent several things depending on how it's written. So I'm probably not going to get quite the right way of saying it, but the sound shi can mean to know, to walk, to watch over or see, to put, to leave, to love, to count on, to explain. Now that's a pretty broad range of verbs there, but there's more. It can also stand for power, world, oath, and house. So everything depends on what other elements are combined with it. So usually a Chinese character would contain a key, which would give the basic meaning and a phonetic element with guidelines on how to pronounce it. Because otherwise, I mean, you wouldn't stand a prayer. Now, talking of which, here's one chanted by a bunch of Tibetan monks from the Tashi Lunpo Temple, from a CD of previously unrecorded chants and mantras. I'll tell you more about it after. Meanwhile, I can't honestly or truthfully say enjoy, but I can merely exhort you to go with it for the next 2 minutes and 3 seconds at least. So here's Tor Bull by the Tashi Lunpo monks of Tibet. Yeah, There you go. Now, I decided on that particular track after discovering it was a prayer to dedicate a torma, or ritual cake, and I didn't want to pass up any opportunity of sampling a bit of cake. Now, the cake and that prayer was dedicated to the victorious goddess defender and guardian of the law, Paldun Lamo, and the flyleaf likes to point out that although she is a wrathful emanation of the goddess Saraswati, her ultimate nature is as a support and protector of compassion, and cake will do that for you. She's also the protector of the Dalai Lama and is especially venerated by the Gelugpa, or the Yellow Hat tradition of monks. Now, when I came across the CD in a charity shop in Pitlochry, Scotland, I thought, ah, oh, how lovely, how charming, Tibetan monks praying. And I was imagining something quite soft and restful. And then I put on the first track and was completely blown away by the loudest, most flatulent horn call to prayer, followed by several solar plexus punching blasts on some other horns. And I was knocked back by a resounding, what the hell? Yes, that's the power of focused words with intention, as is the whole CD. So, prayer. Or is it cake? I don't know. Words, 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 words. Do you remember your first words? I think we're all born into that family oral tradition of our first words, with our parents' delight or bafflement. And books and words, that's my thing. And one of my favourite books, it might seem a bit unlikely, but one of my favourite books is by a writer called Sylvia Ashton Warner, and it's quite simply called Teacher. And it's about her experience teaching mostly Maori children, and what she called her, what she called their key vocabulary. And I was really thrilled to chance upon a film made of her life and the book a few years ago, so that, you know, that really is something to look out for. I'm not sure what it's called, but it's Sylvia Ashton Warner. I'd love to see it again, but anyway, here's an excerpt I'd like to share with you just now, and it's about the key vocabulary and how she worked. First words must mean something to a child. First words must have intense meaning for a child. They must be part of his being. How much hangs on the love of reading, the instinctive inclination to hold a book? Instinctive. That's what it must be. The reaching out for a book needs to become an organic action. What can happen at this yet formative, which can happen at this yet formative age? Pleasant words won't do. Respectable words won't do. They must be words organically tied up, organically born from the dynamic life itself. They must be words that are already part of the child's being. A child, reads a recent publication on the approach of the American books, can be led to feel that Janet and John are friends. Can be led to feel? Why lead him to feel? Or try to lead him to feel that these strangers are friends? What about the passionate feeling he has already for his own friends? To me, it is inorganic to overlook this step. To me, it's an offence against art. And she goes on, no time is too long spent talking to a child to find out his key words, the key that unlocks himself, for in them is the secret of reading, the realization that words can have intense meaning. Words having no emotional significance to him, no instinctive meaning, could be an imposition, doing him more harm than teaching him at all. They may teach him that words mean nothing and that reading is undesirable. So she gives an example of some of the current key vocabulary running through the infant room that week from the newcomers, who are all Maoris. So you have a child called Mohi, and their favourite words are ghost, jeep, jet, skellington, bike, aeroplane, sausage, porridge, egg, car, beer, jersey, and kiss. But Gilbert, his words, his key vocabulary is frog, walnut, truck, king of the rocket men, jet, jeep, beer, tractor, bomb, horse. Rongo prefers peanut, cake, ghost, bed, kiss, and socks. Philip prefers train, boxing, truck, rifle. Phyllis goes for beer, pudding, bus, darling, kiss, and ghost. The words, when I print them on big cards, fill them with smiles and excitement. And so some of the words that you might get in Janet and John, she throws in, are Janet, John, come, look, and see. The boats, little dog, run, here, down, up, aeroplane, my one kitten, one, two, three, play, jump, can, go, horse, ride. With all this in mind, therefore, the intent of the infant room is the nurturing of the organic idea, the preservation of the inner resources, the exercise of the inner eye, and the protraction of the true personality. I like unpredictability and variation. I like drama and I like gaiety. I like peace in the world and I like interesting people. And all this means that I like life in its organic shape. And that's just what you get in an infant room where the creative vent widens. For this is where style is born in both writing and art. For art is the way you do a thing, and an education based on art at once flashes out style. The word jalopy made its fascinating appearance the other day. Brian wrote, I went to town, I came back on a jalopy bus. This word stirred us. The others cross-questioned him on the character of such a bus. It turned out to mean rackety. And although the word was picked up at once, nevertheless they still ask for it to go up on the spelling list. We haven't had jalopy for spelling lately, Brian says. He loves spelling it, which is what I mean when I say that the drive is the children's own. So now we have a track called Word by Lisa Gerrard.
Thank you.
Well, that was Word by Lisa Gerrard, short and sweet, small beginnings. But I need to point out that the word word is actually spelt W-E-R-D in this case, and that's something you'd need to see written down to appreciate the difference. But my next excerpt is from a book about a five-year-old waif and stray called Anna and her unique take on the world, and in this case, her unique take on language. It's from a book by Finn, and it's called Mr. God, This Is Anna. So it's set in Marby's pudding shop, which sold every kind of pudding, sweet or savoury. So there were six of us, Anna and her two special buddies, Bom Bom and Tick Tock, Danny, a young French Canadian, Millie, the Venus de Mile End, and me. We got through our peas pud and steak and kidney pud, and we were on the spotted dick course when the table next to us was occupied by two young men in uniform, French matelots. I'm just going to add in square brackets here that stands for French sailors. Okay. I don't know what led up to the remark, nor will I vouch for its complete accuracy, but suddenly, mon Dieu, dit le matelot, le pudding, il est formidable. Anna's spoon stopped in midair. The mouth, open to receive the spotted dick, opened further with astonishment. Eyes that had been glazed with gustatory pleasure were suddenly prized wide open with question marks. Danny answered the unanswered question. "'S French," he said, with his mouth full. "'What's he say?" asked Anna in a whisper. "'He said the pudding was horrible," laughed Bom Bom. But this was no time for jokes, and Anna did not join in the general laughter. She lowered her spoon to the plate, and as if some colossal offence had been made against her, she said, "'But I don't know what he's talking about.' "'Can I ask him?' she whispered. "'Ask him what?' I queried. "'To write what he said. Sure.' With paper and pencil at the ready, Anna went off to ask the matelot to write it down big about the pudding. Happily, one of the matelot spoke English, so she didn't need my help. And two cups of tea later, she came back to our table and even managed an au revoir in response to their leaving. A few days later, I took her to the public library and showed her textbooks of various languages, but by this time Anna had distilled her astonishment and tucked it in an appropriate corner of her mind. As she explained to me later, it was not really surprising when you got to think about it. After all, cats speak cat language, dogs speak dog language, and trees speak tree language, so it wasn't really surprising that the French people spoke the French language. I had been a little taken aback at Anna's reaction to hearing the French language spoken. She certainly knew of other languages. She could speak rhyming slang and backslang and used a lot of Yiddish words in her own speaking. She was able to talk to Tick Tock in sign language. This was necessary since Tick Tock had been born deaf and dumb. And Braille had intrigued her, and my own interest in ham radio had revealed to her the mysteries of the Morse code. What I did not know at the time of this French encounter was that she was already immersed in the problem of languages. Her reaction to the French language had been more on the lines of, what, another one? It seems that two questions had germinated in her mind concerning language. The first was, can I make a language of my own? The second being, just what is a language? The first question was well on the way to being solved. One evening, I was shown the working out of this adventure. One of the many shoe boxes was taken from the cupboard and placed on the kitchen table. It contained notebooks and many sheets of paper. The first sheet of paper to be taken from the box showed a simple column of numbers on the left-hand side of the page, and on the right-hand side, the word or words corresponding. The fact that it was possible to write five apples with a numeral, and five apples as a word was, I was told, very important. If all numerals could be written as words, then it followed that all words could be written as numerals. A simple substitution of the first 26 numbers in place of the 26 letters obviously did the trick, but writing God as 7, 15, 4 really didn't help very much. Objects could be used as substitutes for letters, or the names of objects could be used. So a reading primer had shown that A is for apple, and of course the implication was that apple is for A. If apple is for A and pear is for P and lemon is for L, and lastly elephant is for E, then the word apple could be represented with the line of objects apple, pear, pear, lemon, elephant. Sheet after sheet of paper showed that Anna had experimented with words, numbers, objects and codes until she had finally come to the conclusion that the problem about inventing a language wasn't that it was very difficult, far from it. The difficulty was, how do you choose amongst so many possibilities? What she did come up with, however, was an adaptation of the Morse code. As this consisted only of dots and dashes, it was pretty plain to see that any two distinct things could be used. As Mr. God had been thoughtful enough to provide a left foot and a right foot, well, these could be used to talk with. A hop on the left foot was to be taken as a dot, a hop on the right foot as a dash. Both feet on the ground was the end of a letter. We got quite good at this kind of communication and could converse over quite large distances. For close work, the scheme was adapted to treading on a line of a paving stone for a dot and treading in the middle of the stone for a dash. And by holding hands and pressing either the little finger or the thumb, we developed a very intimate and private means of conversing. In all, Anna produced 9 different variations of this system. So here we have God by any other name, or is that, is it 7, 15, 4? Anyway, this is Ben's brother, God by any other name.
Just a single moment. If you wasted the moment alone, spent your whole time thinking, why should I need love? Then look above to the sky and beyond.
You stay.
there. Now, I love, 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 love books, and I love how I come by them. I was in a bookshop once in Brighton, and one of the book titles on the shelf really just caught my attention, and it made me laugh. It was called Write It Down, Make It Happen, and the subtitle is Knowing What You Want and Getting It. It's by Henriette Anne Clauser. Now, just before coming out today, it attracted my attention once again. So I opened it up and looked at the introduction, and it made me smile. It was a kind of friendly wave down the corridor of writing history, and it's where we've kind of been already during the show. So I'll just read the introduction. It says, an Egyptian scribe sits on my fireplace hearth. The stone statue is a replica brought back from my trip to Cairo several years ago. He sits cross-legged, a papyrus scroll across his lap and a stylus poised in his hand, ready to write. His eyes are wise and far away, as though he could see the future. He is a symbol of what this book is all about. For the ancient people of the Nile, writing something made it real. In the 1920s and 30s, a host of titles appeared, exclaiming the wonders of the science of thought. Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, Claude M. Bristol's The Magic of Believing, James Allen's As a Man Thinketh, and then in the 50s, David J. Schwartz's The Magic of Thinking Big. Actually, I think I've got most of those, sadly. But anyway, remarkably, all of these books are still in print and readily available at the bookstore now, 50, 60, even 70 years later. As archaic the language, quaint the examples, and blatant the sexism seem today, these books still hit a resonant chord with a modern audience. One small pamphlet written in 1926 and still circulating over 1.5 million copies later is simply called It Works! By R.H.J. This tiny tome sums up the staying power of these proponents of proactive, positive thinking. More than just a glossed over Pollyanna-ish witless approach, they have an important message which It Works puts succinctly in its opening epigram. If you know what you want, you can have it. All our years of brain research, all our current knowledge about the corpus callosum, the reticular activating system and the workings of the human mind, and we are still left with an oh wow sense of wonder that it works. Write It Down, Make It Happen keeps that sense of wonder and is grounded in the same now scientific truth that setting your intent, focusing on the outcome, being clear about what you want in life can make your dreams come true. There is another key element that comes into play, an element that each and every one of these long-lasting books has in common. The first step in all of them is to write down your goal. Now, it's a great book. The title makes me laugh every time. But the thing that she suggests is to write down your ideal, the thing that you would like, the situation you would like, your job, the place that you're living in, your relationship, whatever. Do it in the present tense as if it's happening now. So, you know, wake up with that lovely feeling of, yay, I'm going to work today and you can't wait. Well, what kind of job would that be to wake up with that kind of feeling? Write it down in the present tense, fold it up, put it in a drawer, completely forget about it. That's the premise of how that all works. I'm lost for words now. Sometimes the letting go bit is actually quite important. And sometimes it is about getting out of our own way. So I don't know, maybe it's write it down and let it happen as much as make it happen. But I'm going to leave you now with a track by Gnarls Barkley, and I'm going to leave you with his open book, which actually sounds weirdly Tibetan at the beginning but comes without the cake. I hope that you'll tune in next week. We're going to be taking a look at books, my personal heaven. Okay, I hope to see you next week, and I hope you've been mesmerized. You've got Dave Sharman coming up next with his Strange Boutique. That's after Open Book.